Hello and welcome to Power Problems, a podcast from the Cato Institute, where we offer a skeptical take on US foreign policy and discuss some of today's big questions in international security with guests from across the political spectrum. I'm Emma Ashford.
And I'm Trevor Thrall.
America's history with regime change is long and complicated. From our covert Cold War interventions all the way to the 2003 Iraq War and beyond, we've often intervened in the hopes of obtaining a more congenial regime for American interests, whether it's the US government or whether it's the United Fruit Company. Advocates of regime change point to successful transformations in places like Japan and Germany. But to be honest, if you've been watching the news in the last couple of decades, you've watched Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, you've seen that this process might be a lot more difficult than we've commonly assumed. So joining us today is Ben Dennison, a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Strategic Studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Ben is a scholar of regime change and the author of a recent Cato study on the topic, and that study is called The More Things Change, The More They Stay the Same, The Failure of Regime Change Operations. Ben, welcome to Power Problems.
Thank you for having me.
So, I mean, let's not bury the lead here, right? The conclusion is obvious. Your work and the work of lots of other scholars suggests that regime change doesn't work. Just start by giving us the bottom line. Why does regime change not work?
So, my work and a lot of other scholars' work has often argued that regime change simply doesn't work because it fails to achieve the goals that the interveners normally set out for these missions, whether it be to promote more democracy, to promote more regional stability, improve economic relations, or disimprove interstate relations. No matter what the goal is, no matter how you measure it, after regime change happens, they often just simply, those goals that were thought about at the beginning don't seem to materialize.
And so, you know, it sounds like, and maybe you could say a little bit more here, that there's sort of a number of ways it doesn't work. I mean, it seems like the United States has tried a lot of ways to make regime change work, but it can't find one. And is there sort of a root cause reason why all these different approaches don't seem to work?
So depending on the goal of the regime change mission, the way you might actually try to do regime change might differ. But I think really the root problems with these missions are that, one, they require, there's a fundamental legitimacy gap between having an installed government that is put in place by outsiders and getting the local population to actually support that government, as opposed to kind of an indigenously supported government. And also a fundamental lack of institutional bureaucratic capacity, often with these installed governments, that leads to kind of less state capacity to produce more stable relations, better economies, and less outbreaks of civil wars. So kind of in the process of regime change, you kind of have this problem of you're removing the legitimate government, at least from the perception of the domestic population, through military force. And then you're also destroying kind of bureaucracy that was already there. And then that kind of leaves this vacuum that makes it difficult to fill.
So, I mean, I've often thought that research is kind of interesting because it basically implies that the act of regime change in removing the legitimacy of the government basically means that regime change can never work. It sort of seems like that's what we're arguing here.
That is the case often, that it becomes very difficult to make a government that's imposed by an outside state seem legitimate to the domestic population. There is some research that shows in some very specific cases where you have a large external threat like the Soviet Union, you can overcome that that legitimacy gap, such as in Germany and Japan, because they're so fearful of a potential invasion by the Soviet Union. They're willing to work with kind of the outside power to prevent a different, more nefarious outside power from coming in. But those conditions are often very rare in international politics.
Yeah, it's interesting too, just, you know, because if you think about how difficult civil wars are to end, and how hard it is for a winner in a civil war to be legitimate, it's like you take all those problems and you multiply them by the interstate sort of, you know, outsider problem, and it just gets really nuts.
And in fact, it's actually, what makes it even more difficult than even the civil war problem is that not only do you have this worry about the domestic legitimacy, but then you also have the person who instituted the regime change mission, or the government. So say the United States, when they try to replace a regime abroad, they also have different foreign policies and goals they want that regime to actually carry out. So there's almost a principal agent problem where in doing the things that the U.S. tells their installed regime to do. If they carry it out successfully, it makes them less legitimate to their domestic population. Whereas if they're responding democratically to kind of the issues that the local population actually cares about, that actually then makes them less appealing to the United States or whoever installed this regime. So there's kind of this tension between, do you do the things that the foreign power who installed you wants you to do, or you do the things that your domestic population wants you to do? And that tension kind of really, really spirals in producing some really tough outcomes.
So the question, I guess, really is, why do people, particularly here in Washington, continue to support regime change if it's been unsuccessful? I mean, so we mentioned the cases of Japan and Germany before. Those are the cases that are most commonly pointed to as successes. Are there other successes? Are there other reasons why people continue to advocate for regime change?
So I'll just quickly flag that this tradition of American regime change behavior actually goes back even further, at least back to 1898, if not earlier. So there is kind of this American tradition of thinking that promoting democracy abroad through armed force could be a viable way to create more security in, for the United States and produce more governments that are more in line with their interests. But in recent years, there seems to be this persistent idea that if you can't get a government to agree to a certain diplomatic negotiation, or there's some really tough problem that you can't square away with the government, it might just be easier and quicker just to change the government abroad and then get a government who will negotiate with you, and then you can solve that problem. It's kind of this persistent myth that, oh, regime change will be quick and easy. We can get in, we can get out, and we won't have to stay there long, and we can get the goals that we want. Unfortunately, often once you remove that regime, you end up having a situation where things are not as easy as you thought they would be. You don't have as much knowledge about kind of the local dynamics that are on the ground, and it ends up spiraling into a much broader, much more complicated mission than you ever intended. So I really think this kind of belief that things can be quick and easy is this kind of psychological bias that many people still have that needs to be kind of squared.
Let's back up for a second, because we've been talking about regime change here, and we haven't actually defined it, because there's regime change, right? And then there's military intervention. And then there's sort of other forms of intervention in states. And I'm curious, you know, where do you draw the line between those things? What is it that counts as regime change versus just, you know, military intervention? Because we do all these things, and there's a variety of interventions, particularly in the post-Cold War space, that I'm not sure if they're regime change or not.
So, yeah, a lot of these things actually then kind of blend together, which makes it trying to study this a little difficult. I usually use kind of a general definition of regime change as using armed force or the threat of armed force to impose a new regime in a foreign country. So really trying to look at how the use of military force can be used to actually install a regime. And oftentimes that can, it can start as an intervention where you're just trying to intervene in maybe a civil war, but then you realize, or a country realizes, that the only way to get the outcome that they want would be to replacing the government and installing it that way. So an intervention itself is kind of the use of armed force without necessarily targeting the actual who is governing in the country. But once you get into who is going to govern kind of after the war, then that becomes, or you're toppling who's currently governing, that would be where regime change kind of crosses that line. And oftentimes you can actually go from regime change even to a broader intervention as well. So these things can kind of go both directions. And that makes trying to figure out exactly what people are, what policymakers might be advocating for, a little difficult.
What about covert interventions? Because I know there's been some pretty good literature on this. I'm thinking of Lindsay O'Rourke's book in particular. But the idea that sometimes, you know, perhaps we just engage in a little internal meddling with elites in a country, say in Iran in the 1950s, and we topple the existing government, we get the government we want, but it's not a military intervention. Where do you put that kind of covert regime change? Where does that fit in your mental model of this stuff?
So I think covert intervention, and I'll echo that Lindsay's book is absolutely fantastic. It's often done because you recognize that there are these broader constraints that a full-scale military intervention would prevent you from engaging in something on that scale. So you still want to try to get a quick and easy policy change without the investment. Unfortunately, from her book and other research, These covert regime change operations often are less successful than the overt attempts. It's actually very difficult to try to use covert tools to overthrow an existing government. And so these, you know, even though they've been attempted throughout various moments in time, they're often less likely to actually achieve even just overthrowing the government, never mind their goals and whatnot. The benefit, I guess, of covert versus overt, though, is you're less likely to then spiral into these even broader nation building missions that you can when you engage in overt regime change. So at least, you know, you're constraining yourself a little bit to give yourself plausible deniability, but it's actually less likely to even overthrow the government than the overt attempts.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think, you know, the covert strategy, and you came close to saying this with the plausible deniability thing is part of the reason you need that as the United States, you know, part is because we're trying to protect our sort of liberal good name. You know, this is not really behavior that a polite democracy should be engaging in. So you're trying to do it sneakily. But that sort of raises a broader question for me about the efficiency or effectiveness of, you know, military intervention generally, but regime change in particular, which is, you know, sometimes you hear from, you know, neocons, I guess, mostly, but even, you know, say in the case of Afghanistan, you heard it from former, you know, commanders there, you know, we could win here if we just tried harder longer and weren't so nice. And, you know, I think back to the Romans, like, you know, the Romans sort of knew how to take over countries and install new regimes. And, you know, you don't play nice. You don't play like a democracy to do that. Is it possible we're just not doing it right because we're scared of getting a bad reputation?
So there are folks who do argue, you know, make this claim that if you were to do kind of to match the proper nation building strategy, or the proper regime change strategy, you would be able to achieve more goals. A lot of people are focused on kind of the Marshall Plan as maybe that providing resources to Europe to allow for kind of the occupation of Germany to succeed. Unfortunately, if you look at kind of what the reports come in on Afghanistan, we've already spent more money for if you even with the adjusted dollars in Afghanistan than we ever spent on the Marshall Plan. So that gives us, you know, maybe we're not doing things exactly right. But I think the biggest inhibition to this idea that if you had the right strategy or the right ideas, you would be able to do regime change more effectively or intervention more effectively. It requires you having the knowledge about the local government and the local institutions and the local population prior to the intervention or prior to the regime change mission to actually know what type of strategy would succeed. And I, from my own research and looking at many of these cases, that level of information, that fine-grained detail you would need to know to, you know, even have a chance at trying to successfully change these governments just doesn't exist. There's not the kind of intelligence being gathered. It's very difficult. For example, if you're going to go to war with a country, they're not going to be willing to let, you know, your diplomats and your intelligence officers come in before the war and search around and figure out how best we can actually understand these institutions. So it becomes really difficult to actually get this strategy correct beforehand. And it's really not, unfortunately, until you actually arrive in the territory that you can even begin trying to figure out how all these different institutional constraints might make things even more difficult than you initially believed.
I gotta say, Trevor, that argument drives me crazy because it is such and I think this is the problem with the broader literature on regime change more generally, is it's such a US-centric argument. Because while we can say, you know, maybe the US has been particularly prone in the last, you know, 50, 60, 70 years towards regime change, there are other countries and other great powers that have engaged in this for years and years and years. Just take Afghanistan, right? The Soviets had the exact same experience in Afghanistan that we did. Before them, the British had the exact same experience in Afghanistan. This isn't about sort of America's inability to do regime change. This is, as Ben was pointing out, this is the fact that those informational problems and extending control away from your state a long way, it's all very difficult in that foreign setting. And that applies to every country that's trying to do this. It's not just America.
Yeah, sure. I guess I totally agree with you. But devil's advocate wise, the British Empire was very effective at regime change, right? You just have to be willing to do things that are anti-democratic, right? I mean, that I think there's no question. We could take over Afghanistan and run it as a protectorate, no problem.
See, I'm not so sure about that because, I agree with you that it's easier when you're not trying to be nice. It's perhaps easier when you're not saying, oh, we have to install a democracy. But I mean, again, I just want to come back to the Soviet experience in Afghanistan. They were utterly brutal. They were willing to do things we would not consider in 1,000 years, and it didn't work. It didn't work at all. Ben, I feel like we've sort of been talking over you. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I'll just add for the British example, you also have to think, you can think back, there was when you talk to people who study colonization and colonial rule and imperialism, they talk about the difference between indirect rule and direct rule, which is kind of, we don't use those terms anymore because we're not in the business of empire, as our former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld told us. But those terms kind of fit well with the British. What they were doing was kind of leaving a lot of the current institutions in place in places like Afghanistan and in other parts of the world where they were engaging in regime change and just trying to get a leader to change, then basically pay their tribute to the British Empire rather than necessarily kind of overhauling the entire institutional system like the Soviets and the U.S. have both tried in Afghanistan. So in a sense, what the literature has shown is that if you're able to just change a leader and not change the underlying institutions, you're more likely to succeed in the regime change mission. The problem is the number of cases you can do just change that very top layer leaders is very, very small. I mean, this was the plan that the U.S. actually had for Iraq. If you look at the planning documents before the war, the idea was you could just remove Saddam and maybe the top level layer of Ba'athists. And once they arrived in the country, they realized that plan was completely inadequate for the kinds of goals that they had.
Yeah. Well, I think that's exactly the strategy that the United States, played corporate sort of empire strategy with the Central America and stuff, which is you go in and you pay off the elites. You don't remove them. You just make it worth their while to play ball. And I think you could make an argument. I mean, as sleazy as many, many, many of those efforts were, and they often led to bad things in those countries, corruption, all that sort of jazz. But that's certainly a cheaper and less bloody way to try than actually invading and toppling governments and so on.
Yeah, definitely. I think, that is kind of, I think in general, what you see is that throughout, history, even beyond, the U.S. and even the British, that is just co-opting elites is almost always cheaper and less bloody and better for, the protection of human rights almost at sometimes than kind of toppling all the institutions and trying to build them from scratch.
Okay, so before we all start accidentally making the case for a new wave of covert regime change, let's pull back a little here.
Yes.
Let's pull back to what it is that we're doing today, because regime change in sort of the modern American vernacular is talking about a very specific set of things. It's talking about Libya and Iraq. It's talking about our interventions in Syria or other places, basically all this stuff since 1991 in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And I think it would be really interesting to maybe talk through a couple of those examples and talk about just the practical implications of regime change in those places. What have we learned from it?
I think both the Iraq and Libya cases provide an interesting case of learning from these cases, at least in terms of how our presidents and decision makers have learned from each of these cases. In Iraq, this is kind of the first kind of, even though it comes after the Afghanistan invasion, it's kind of the, first big attempt at large-scale regime change in the Bush administration. And there's this kind of belief that you can simply go in, you can get in, you can topple the Saddam regime very quickly, then you can exit the country very quickly and have a new flourishing democracy in Iraq. That obviously did not actually occur. It required actually devolved into a lengthy state-building mission. American troops are still in Iraq for a variety of reasons, and it's kind of ended up destabilizing the region rather than providing the stability that folks thought. In Libya, there was actually great resistance, I think, initially to doing the regime change mission because of the fears that it might turn into a similar type mission as the Iraq War and also Afghanistan didn't do. So there was some kind of learning, but that learning kind of eventually, because of the conditions on the ground and different people in the White House, they got convinced that maybe we need to go engage in this mission to overthrow the Gaddafi regime. And interestingly enough, if you look at President Obama, he said when he was doing all these interviews, when he was leaving office, he said that one of his biggest lessons he learned in his time as president is that don't do types of wars like the Libya war without a clear exit strategy and without a clear plan for what comes the day after. Now, he just kind of thought that the day after would kind of everything would wake up and be happy in Libya. And instead it devolved in kind of this brutal civil war that's still going on. So in that case, there has been some learning, at least among some folks in Washington, that, you know, you should be very resistant to get in these types of wars and always have a plan for the day after. But unfortunately, there are still folks who think that we can plan well for the day after and we can make a good plan in order to, you know, avoid Iraq and avoid Libya and kind of still be able to do these types of things in Venezuela or Iran. And that leads to some major, major problems in the policymaking world today. It's also important to talk about that both of those cases ended up having effects on other great powers in the international system. So Russia and China look at the Iraq war and look at Libya, and they see that as demonstrating American regime change intent. And that causes them to think that American democracy promotion efforts or sanctions policy or even humanitarian aid is all kind of a scheme to get regime change started in various countries. Even though it usually isn't, it's just kind of regime changes in the past have actually ended up harming American foreign policy in all these other different venues. And I don't think many policymakers actually recognize that.
Has the rationale for regime change changed in your opinion? Because so looking at this as somewhat of an outsider, it seems to me that in the Obama administration, particularly with Libya, there was a really strong emphasis on the responsibility to protect idea. And that showed up again in the Syria debates, even though we didn't actually sort of engage in a major military intervention there. And that's very different from the way the Bush administration was conceptualizing regime change. So is the rationale shifting over time, or is it just that policymakers sort of grab whatever rationale seems most useful at the time?
Well, I think there is at least internal logic or rationale among the different administrations. And it's, you know, largely the goals you might want to engage with for in order to launch these regime change operations. It changes over time, but it all comes down to kind of there is some goal that we want. And in order to get that goal, we have to remove these governments. I mean, back in the Reagan administration, when we were just talking about lots of the Central American cases, you know, they actually human rights and democracy was actually the justification they gave for a lot of their covert actions in Central America. So it was kind of similar in a weird way to the responsibility to protect, kind of saying these governments, we have to not allow these communist governments to come to power and will harm human rights and democracy and things of that nature. But I think today what we're often seeing is kind of this idea of we decide which types of regimes are the ones that we will accept as being able to talk for their citizens and willing to represent their countries on the international stage. And if we don't see the legitimacy of that regime, that's when you start seeing actions to try to destabilize that regime or trying to find ways to kind of get a different type of government in place, which is, I think, leads to a lot of the problems that we're seeing with the crises in Iran and Venezuela and North Korea as well.
Well, I think that's probably a good segue into a closing question, which is the topic is salient again. I mean, it's pretty much always salient in Washington. And the crises that you mentioned there, Iran and Venezuela in particular, North Korea a couple of years ago, more so, I think. Yeah. But those are places where the Trump administration has suggested regime change. Some of its fellow travelers have suggested regime change. I guess just what are your broad thoughts on that?
So I think in all those cases, it's incredibly harmful, you know, for the various crises that are going on. There's like clear international problems in both Venezuela and Iran, and these kind of latent threats of regime change end up making it more difficult to find a solution that is mutually acceptable to both sides. In Venezuela, you have a clear humanitarian crisis in addition to a political crisis, and trying to get the United States to kind of had this regime change threat over the Maduro regime makes them less likely to accept, you know, humanitarian aid coming into the country from American NGOs. It's making it harder to kind of get a negotiated regional solution to try to find a way to kind of solve this massive humanitarian issue. And so while, you know, trying to do things to, you know, help human rights in these various countries is a positive thing, by having this looming threat of regime change over top of it, it makes them less likely to actually work with different branches of the United States foreign policy bureaucracy or other regional actors to try to solve the problem. If you look at the Iranian situation there, where we're worried about Iran's nuclear program, you know, pretty much everything that the Trump administration has done since coming into office has convinced, you know, made it sound like they're interested in overthrowing the regime in Tehran. And so at this point, looking at how the Trump administration talks about North Korea, versus how it talks about Iran, it makes it clear that there's no reason why the Iranians shouldn't try to go and get a nuclear bomb for themselves in order to protect their regime from any potential strikes against it by the Trump administration. And that's, you know, a situation that is not necessarily conducive to global stability or regional stability, having the Iranians trying to get a nuclear bomb. So in that case, in both cases, it seems that rather than trying to make a quick and easy solution to either of these crises, these kind of discussions of regime change around all these hotspots and only end up making the crisis more difficult to resolve and potentially makes it even more destabilizing.
Yeah, there's a quote from the Nobel laureate Thomas Schelling back before his death that I really loved. And it was, he basically said, American non-proliferation policy, and by that he meant the invasion of Iraq, American non-proliferation policy is now the greatest driver of nuclear proliferation. And I honestly think that should be engraved in stone somewhere in Washington.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, when you convince the rest of the world that regime change is your goal, you force all discussion from that point forward into a zero-sum thing. And that makes negotiating brutally difficult because the other team is sure that you're, you know, either lying, cheating, or going to coerce them into losing something, you know, precious, if not, you know, outright destroy them. And even in the cases where we would like to negotiate, you can't really get started if that's what they're thinking.
Yeah, I mean, even if you look at arms negotiations with Russia, you'll see in certain discussions, you know, this kind of underlying fear that, you know, if there is American first strike capabilities, it's going to be to target the regime, not necessarily the territorial integrity of Russia, but there's a threat to, you know, regime decapitation strike. And this is kind of a real fear in some of those in these negotiations, even though there's nothing that, you know, it's not that the U.S. is interested in doing that, but we've shown intent around the world that we are interested in engaging in regime change. So why wouldn't we try it in somewhere else as well?
Well, it's not really a happy note, but I think that's all we have time for today. So thanks, everybody, for being here. Thank you, Ben, for talking to us today. Thanks to our producer, Cecil Sherman, and to everyone at home for listening. If you want to continue the conversation on Twitter, our handle is @PowerProblems. And if you like the show, do leave us a good review on iTunes or wherever else you find your podcasts.